This podcast is brought to you by DIA, the trusted global neutral forum for healthcare product development professionals. DIA, driving insights to action.
My name is Richard Zink, Vice President of Biostatistics at Lexitas Pharma Services and Associate Editor of Therapeutic Innovation and Regulatory Science. Today, I have the privilege of speaking with Dr. Alyssa Lavange, Professor and Interim Co-Chair of the Department of Biostatistics at UNC Chapel Hill. Dr. Lavange was formerly Director of the Office of Biostatistics at the Center of Drug Evaluation and Research at the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. During her time at FDA, Dr. Lavange and CDER Director Dr. Janet Woodcock were among the earliest proponents of master protocol clinical trial designs. For these efforts, Drs. Lavange and Woodcock received the DIA America's 2020 Chairs Award for Outstanding Contribution to Global Health. Dr. Lavange serves as a member of the Therapeutics Clinical Committee and is co-chair of the Master Protocol Subcommittee for the public-private partnership called Accelerating COVID-19 Therapeutic Innovations and Vaccines, ACTIV for short, launched by the U.S. National Institutes of Health and led by NIH Director Francis Collins. She joins us today to discuss and explain this critical clinical concept. Thank you for joining us today, Alyssa, and welcome.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here talking about one of my favorite subjects.
To begin, there's a lot of different terminology surrounding master protocols, including platform trials, umbrella trials, basket trials. Could you please describe these terms on a summary level and how they're used in research?
I understand there is no uniform accepted set of definitions for any of these terms. They've just evolved, I think, with use and practice. The definition I like to use for master protocols is multiple diseases, multiple patient subgroups, and or multiple therapies are studied under one overarching protocol. That's what I call a master protocol, and it's a very broad, open definition. There are other terms that I think master protocol encompasses. The two probably earliest used terms were umbrella trials and basket trials. Umbrella trials tend to refer to trials of one disease with multiple drugs or interventions being studied. An early example of this was the MATCH trial from the National Cancer Institute. And then the other term, basket trials, is analogous to that, but more one drug being studied in multiple diseases, disease subtypes, or cohorts. And an early example of that would be the B225 protocol of imatinib. These trial types evolved mostly in oncology, and you can think of a basket trial looking at a drug that goes after a particular tumor type, and that tumor type might be manifested in different histologies or different cancer subtypes. An umbrella trial, on the other hand, would be a single disease and multiple drugs, possibly or potentially matched to a patient subtype, but the disease itself would be the common denominator. And then there are variations on both of those types. The other term you mentioned was adaptive platform, and let me talk about that in a little bit different way. The terms that I tend to see getting used interchangeably are master protocols, platform trials, adaptive trials, and all three of those I like to point out when I'm talking to different audiences have a little bit different meaning. So I've already mentioned what the concept of a master protocol is, and in the simplest term, it's just the protocol. It's the umbrella under which something is being studied. That's a little bit more complex than a single intervention, single disease clinical trial. But the protocol document in a master protocol stands alone. You think of the protocol document as being written really without mention of any particular treatment or drug. And then appendices can be added to the protocol for the drugs that enter into the study, which may all be defined at the very start of the trial, or they may come into the trial at different times as they become available. Now, if you do set up a master protocol and drugs can come into the trial at different times, then that's what's commonly referred to as a platform trial. You just envision a platform that's set up with all of the trial infrastructure that you need. You have an overarching master protocol to run the trial, and then drugs can come in and leave at different times. Now, the coming in at different times really just requires a platform. Drugs leaving a study at different times requires some kind of adaptation or decision. So that's where we get adaptive trials, which are often adaptive platform trials, meaning you are looking at the data as you go, and based on that data accumulating for a particular treatment, the drug or the treatment may leave the trial early for futility, or it may leave the trial early for evidence of efficacy that supports further study outside of the platform. So you commonly see an adaptive platform trial being executed under a master protocol, and that is the structure that I have the most experience with. But again, you can have a master protocol that begins with, say, three drugs. No more drugs are going to enter the trial. You're going to study these three drugs under one master protocol. You may study each of those drugs respective with placebo or compared to placebo or standard of care. You may study those drugs compared to each other. It doesn't matter. If there's no movement of new drugs coming in, you don't need a platform trial. You don't even really need an adaptive trial. You're just studying multiple drugs under one protocol. And it's a little more open-ended than a traditional factorial design, which has got some structure to it that we don't necessarily require for a master protocol. Those are the common structures. The one other thing I would say, if I think of a sort of a classical master protocol, well, I'm saying classical now because I think over the last 4 or 5 years, we've had enough master protocols that it's starting to be more common. But I think, on the other hand, the concept is still fairly new. If I think of a master protocol with an adaptive platform trial, I can think of a couple of other dimensions that are used to define it. One is that the trial itself may be an exploratory trial where you're screening lots of agents to see which agents have a signal, and that signal could then warrant further study, possibly a phase 3 confirmatory trial to support regulatory approval. The classic example to me of that adaptive platform trial is the I-SPY2 trial in neoadjuvant breast cancer. And it is the longest running adaptive platform trial that has really defined a lot of this field. On the right-hand side, the concept of the sub-trials really being run independently. The classic example of that is the LungMap trial, which comes out of a collaboration that was spurred on by the Friends of Cancer Research, as well as multiple pharmaceutical companies and the FNIH. Both of those give you a good example if you want to read about the different ways master protocols and adaptive platform trials can be run. You might, on the other hand, run a master protocol with this adaptive platform structure where you're looking at multiple drugs, and for each of these, you're trying to generate confirmative evidence that could support a regulatory approval. If I think of those two as being two ends of a spectrum, from early phase signal finding trial to later phase confirmatory type trial, they both work in a platform setting under a master protocol. One difference would be that in the earlier trial, you're looking for signals and you may also be looking for the best signal. You might have two or three drugs for the same patient subtype or disease subtype, and you want to see which one of those looks best to go on for further study. At the confirmatory end, the later phase end of this master protocol platform trial, you may be looking at each of these drugs completely independently of each other. The fact that they're in the same master protocol is really for efficiency. It's because they are all going after the same disease, and there's a lot of advantages, which we'll talk about more. In that case, each of those drugs may be studied relative to a matching placebo or standard of care plus placebo if they're an add-on therapy. And you basically are running sub-trials that are more or less independent of each other. It's just that you're using the master protocol and the platform and the investment that that brings with it to gain some efficiencies in studying these drugs all at once. The terminology of master protocol and adaptive platform can encompass those two extremes and multiple trial designs in between.
Thanks for the clarity. And I think it was very clear about describing all the different terminology and particularly how broad master protocols can be in comparing multiple drugs to one another, or even getting as specific to sort of treating each novel agent within the master protocol within its own sort of sub-trial, as you described. I hadn't really heard it talked about in that fashion. What would you say are some of the types of clinical trial innovations? We hinted at some of them, or you hinted at some of them in the previous response. What are these innovations that master protocol designs make possible, and how would they benefit sponsors, researchers, patients, and regulators for these particular innovations?
I tend to think of innovation in two flavors. Master protocols are collaborative. The concept of multiple drugs, possibly multiple diseases, multiple patient subtypes, or subgroups being studied require some upfront planning and some infrastructure building. And this infrastructure building is important because it does drive a lot of the potential efficiencies. Basically, if you put the right infrastructure in place, you can streamline the trial logistics, improve the data quality, and facilitate data sharing and potentially other types of data collection. I'll talk about that in a minute. That's one area for innovation. The other is that these types of structures lend themselves quite nicely to innovative clinical trial designs, to innovative statistical approaches. And I'll give some examples of that as well. So just briefly, on the infrastructure side, one of the first innovations on the infrastructure side that's very important to patients and speaks to why patient advocacy groups are often behind master protocol efforts is the use of a centralized screening platform to determine who's eligible for what drug or who's eligible for what subtrial, depending on how you're setting up your master protocol. And this is very efficient to patients, and it's much more efficient than having to be screened sequentially for one trial, then another trial, then another trial. The idea that a patient can go to this one-stop shop, have their biomarkers profiled, whatever other screening elements are required, and then based on that, determine which of several treatments they might be eligible for, which would be safe for them to take in a trial, and which might be more likely to benefit them based on their profile of the patient characteristics and the biomarker results. That one-stop shop is very attractive. And then the patient can go off to the treatment assignment that makes the most sense or the subtrial that makes the most sense for them. That screening platform, that common screening platform, it takes a while to get it set up. You try to anticipate all the treatments that may be coming into the trial later on and make sure you do the biomarker screening suitable for those treatments if they are treatments targeting a particular disease subtype. But the other systems that are in place are not that novel. The central randomization, central electronic data capture, the training on these systems being in place for the trial network, just setting the trial network up itself, the clinics and the sites, the centralized governance, a single steering committee, a single data and safety monitoring board or data monitoring committee, a single IRB, single adjudication committees, pretty much anything you can think of dealing with trial governance, you would want to have just one of those for the master protocol, but they oversee all of the treatments that are going through this protocol. This governance also requires you to work out in advance how data will be shared. If data are shared, control patients, for example, and they contribute to two different regulatory submissions, how is that going to work in terms of firewalls and things like that? And then finally, publication issues can be worked out in advance. The use of central laboratories, central reading centers for quality control oversight, the use of common CRFs, as much as they can be common, you don't want drug-specific case report forms. You would really want common case report forms consistent with the master protocol, and then add individual things as a single drug might need them, a particular safety blood draws, for example, for one drug that another drug doesn't need. That kind of focus on the commonality, the common elements of the protocols and all the infrastructure that makes the trial happen. It's an investment up front, but the payoff on the long term can really make a difference, not only in resources, but in time. Stopping and starting protocols can be a time-consuming process. Having an infrastructure in place, a machine that continues to run as drugs enter the study without too much pause, you can see the advantages that that might take. I consider that innovation. Maybe it's not so innovative if you think back to the early NIH clinical trial networks and coordinating centers that have been in place, pioneered by NHLBI many decades ago. But for this type of collaborative effort, I think the infrastructure has some innovative ideas in it. The more fun innovation to talk about would be the design possibilities, the statistical aspects of the design. And hands down, in my experience, the single most common and most appealing innovation is sharing control patients across drugs. If it makes sense, for example, if you're studying two drugs that target a different biomarker profile of patient, then it may not make sense to share controls with those two drugs. But if you have two drugs targeting the disease and you've got basically the same patients for that disease or for that biomarker profile subtype, then why not share the control patients? Why double the placebo patients if you're needed? And this is the feature that people seem to just gravitate towards. It's very concrete. It's easy to see that you can really save time and patient resources. Patients are a scarce resource, and you don't want to waste patients' time in a trial when you don't need to. So sharing the control patients, it does carry with it working out in advance, as I said before, issues about data sharing, because those same control patients could contribute to two different analyses, two different regulatory submissions for two different drugs. And don't forget, if you set up the adaptive platform trial the right way and randomization is central, then you can have two drugs being studied at once with a shared control group. Another third drug may come in and it shares the same control group, and maybe an early drug finishes. You can change these randomization allocations from 1:1:1 to 1:1:1:1, and then you drop back to three groups, whatever way you need to do this. I mean, it's not easy, but it's definitely doable. All right, so that's shared controls. The other sort of natural innovation, if you're looking at a master protocol with multiple drugs, especially if you're in a early signal detection or screening trial and you're trying to find agents, several agents might be considered possible treatments for one type of patient in the disease that's being studied, then you may want to do some kind of adaptive randomization. And I-SPY 2 is an example where response adaptive randomization has been used to good effect. And there are a lot of reasons to consider response adaptive randomization, but I won't go into the details. That's a topic for another podcast, perhaps. Just suffice it to say there are statistical properties, there's ethical considerations, and there's practical considerations that would make one want to at least think about response adaptive randomization, though they do carry with them some controversy. They've gotten a lot of attention in the literature lately. Covariate adaptive randomization to just help a little bit with potential confounding factors and improve your power, that's certainly something that could be used as well. And then adaptive enrichment, where you over-enroll, you favor randomization in a subgroup to a drug that's more likely to benefit that subgroup. You might have a biomarker positive and biomarker negative subgroup, and you want to favor randomization among the biomarker positive groups. You could even do that exclusively, or you could do some randomization. You could tilt the randomization towards biomarker positives, but include some biomarker negative patients in the group that receives the drug so that you can look and see if your adaptive enrichment design is working, or maybe your criteria for what differentiates a positive from a negative needs tweaking a little bit. And you can even incorporate that in a precision health type interim analysis if you want to. Maybe one other thing I'll mention is the use of external controls. Just as it makes sense to share controls in a master protocol, there may also be an opportunity to find a good source of external control data. And sometimes you'll have a master protocol running. LungMap is an example of this, where the study started with four different biomarker defined subgroups, and a fifth group was called the no-match group. And the no-match group basically included patients that didn't have a drug targeted for their particular biomarker profile, but they were enrolled anyway. And in fact, there was a test drug randomized comparison plan for them from the beginning. The study's been redesigned a couple of times as new drugs get approved. But in that sense, you can think of accumulating data on patients that may not be eligible for any of the drugs for various reasons, but they themselves could be considered an external control group for possibly future analyses. So there is some element of innovation through the use of external controls in these types of trials as well. The other innovations are just not that much different than any adaptive design. Frequent monitoring of the data, possibly designing a seamless phase 2-3 trial with graduation rules, use of Bayesian methods for any number of reasons. None of those are unique to master protocols. They're all the innovations usually associated with an adaptive clinical trial, but they may make sense in a master protocol. And if there's an investment, you know, the investment of possibly extensive computer simulations to design the study, any kind of upfront investment like that, sometimes it makes sense for that investment when you're going to be studying a lot of treatments. And I think that's why innovation kind of gravitates towards master protocols, because that is the place where that type of investment can have a nice payoff.
So I wanted to ask a follow-up about that in terms of the structure that you mentioned at the beginning of your answer, or the infrastructure. Who would be responsible for sort of building this infrastructure or monitoring this infrastructure? Would it be a group within the government? Would it be a foundation specific to a particular disease or a consortium of pharmaceutical companies? Who would sort of be responsible for that?
All of the above. I think you see a lot of variability. That's an excellent question, Richard. Who in the world is going to pay for all of this infrastructure, and how do you even make it happen? The successes that I've seen, again, going back to the two examples that Janet Woodcock, the director of CDER and someone who I have immense admiration for, and I had an opportunity to publish a paper about master protocols way back in 2016 in the New England Journal. It was a review article at the time. That is the paper where I use I-SPY 2 and LungMap as examples of master protocols at either end of the trial spectrum. But in both of those cases, there was a pretty strong catalyst. In the I-SPY 2 case, the investigators themselves were frustrated with the slowness of clinical trial designs and drug development at the time, especially in the emergency medicine arena. And the neoadjuvant breast cancer was a good example to try out some of their ideas. The consortium evolved, but it included the foundations for the NIH, the FNIH, as well as the FDA, as well as pharmaceutical companies, as well as other academic investigators. And then in LungMap, the patient advocacy group, the Friends of Cancer Research, really was the catalyst to get LungMap started. But again, with much involvement from the FNIH, from the FDA, from drug companies and other partners, these are all big collaborative efforts. And the investment has to come from somewhere. More recently, particularly since I've been back in academia, I've been aware of NIH efforts to fund master protocols and the PRECISE master protocol, precision interventions for severe or exacerbation prone asthma, is something that's funded by the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute, NHLBI. The resources to establish the infrastructure for that master protocol are coming from the NIH. But it still requires collaboration because you've got to get the drugs to study in the trial. You've got to have a lot of partners to pull these off. Planning the infrastructure, figuring out the funding has to happen up front. And I think there are different models, and I would encourage people who are interested to explore all the different models and just talk to people who are running master protocols now to see what worked for them.
This may reference some of the examples you've already talked about, but are there some recent successes with master protocols you'd like to highlight? And for these examples, do you think they could have been conducted with more traditional designs and still been successful?
Using the two examples I've been using, I think that I-SPY 2 now purports to have studied between 16 and 20 different drugs for the treatment of neoadjuvant breast cancer. And several of them have graduated for further study. And there are papers in the New England Journal of Medicine talking about a couple of their successes. The LungMap study, which launched right before the approval of an immunotherapy that changed the standard of care for the study and caused a redesign, has been running for 5 years. And they have tested, as of the end of 2019, when they hit their 5th year anniversary, there's a nice article about them in the Cancer Letter. In that article, they say we've tested 12 therapies in 5 years. We think that's a faster track record than a typical single drug, single biomarker cancer trial could have ever accomplished. All of the master protocols that I've been involved with today, pretty much all of them feel like they've done something they could not have done if they were waiting for sequential trials. But that's not to say that's all there is. Individual standalone trials are not going to go away. I think you have to have the right combination of disease state, targeted therapies, interest in personalized medicine, some motivating factor to choose a master protocol, because they are not for the faint of heart, right? They do require quite a bit more upfront planning and so forth. But those that are launched and have been running for a while, they've been able to study a large number of drugs in a really smart way, and I think would consider themselves successes.
And are there unique challenges that make master protocol trials difficult for industry to execute or difficult for regulators to regulate?
In terms of difficult for industry to execute, you do have to have industries willing to collaborate. I mean, it's a little bit counter to the commercial model that pharmaceutical companies, how they do their business. they're in competition with each other. So why would they all go in together to study their drugs in the same master protocol if they're all trying to get to market first? There has to be some advantage. And I think that's the difficulty, is showing what that advantage would be. But from the eyes of the patient, from the patient's perspective, it's a win-win. That means a lot. From the regulator side, these master protocols can end up being pretty complex. They invite innovation, I've already mentioned. The fact that you've got multiple drugs, you may have multiple biomarker matches, you may have a lot of adaptations, things coming and going, a lot of moving parts. They're not going to be as simple to review from a regulator standpoint as a single drug, two-arm, parallel group, randomized controlled clinical trial. The fact that the drugs are coming and going means you don't just review the protocol once and you're done. You review an amendment for this drug and an amendment for that drug, and then maybe the exclusion criteria change. And then there's an adaptation and there's another protocol change and a drug graduates. They can be complicated and they do put a burden on the regulators. I will say, in the Center for Drugs, largely to Dr. Woodcock's leadership, the review divisions have been very welcoming, in my experience, to master protocols. And there is an advantage there in that multiple pharmaceutical companies will be involved in a single master protocol, and you have one set of FDA interactions. So all the players are hearing the same advice from the FDA. And that in and of itself can be quite efficient. I mentioned LungMap a minute ago, and the fact that because of a drug approval, they had to have a redesign shortly after they launched. That was actually criticized by some. There were four biomarker match subtrials, a no match subtrial. And as soon as it launches, you have to shut them all down because the standard of care is now obsolete with the approval of this new drug. But on the other hand, on the glass half full side, well, there's one steering committee, one data monitoring committee, one group of people that come together and make a decision on the redesign that affects five different subtrials. So isn't that efficient? That's how you argue the efficiency of the collaboration, how smart the collaboration can be in getting the answers that you want about different drugs from different companies. That's a way that you can overcome the competitive tendencies that would argue against collaboration. And in both cases, I've had very good experiences, both with the pharma companies involved in a master protocol and the regulatory division.
What can we do or establish today that will advance the use of master protocols to improve how we develop therapies for diseases tomorrow? You mentioned some of the reticence of pharmaceutical companies due to the commercial aspects. What would have to happen, for example, to make them more open to these kinds of trials?
The more experience we get with master protocols and the more we can publish that experience so that we get the word out, the easier it will be for people to decide whether there's an advantage or not for them to enter the master protocol. You're a statistician, I'm a statistician. If we have data, we can make decisions. It's hard if it's all hypothetical. We do have data now. There are actually a number of papers that have appeared, both positive and negative, about master protocols. We've also got guidance coming from the FDA, from the EMA, about complex trial designs, including master protocols. As much information as can be shared publicly, I think that really is the advantage. That will let people see these as not just a big black box, but, oh, this is a viable option for my study of this drug. I will say there's nothing quite like an emergency, like the current pandemic. If I could talk about that for a minute, actually go back to 2015, the Ebola pandemic, the outbreak in West Africa, started a master protocol, the PREVAIL 2 trial, that the statisticians at NIAID designed and worked with statisticians and others at the FDA to set up that study so that it would provide evidence for approval of a drug against Ebola. That outbreak died down before the study could finish, but it was set up as a master protocol. It started with one drug and the control group was palliative care. The idea was, as soon as we had an answer on that drug, another drug would come in. If that drug looked positive, it would become standard of care. A new drug would come in and try to beat that standard of care. And this was meant to be a master protocol that would go on quite some time, as long as the pandemic did. And that replacing the standard of care is another innovation that I didn't mention earlier, but it makes the analysis pretty tricky. So now we've got the COVID pandemic, and I think it's telling that Francis Collins launched the Accelerating COVID-19 Therapeutic Interventions and Vaccines, or ACTIVE initiative, in March. It's on the NIH website and also in a, I believe, a JAMA article. And this basically was an initiative to launch multiple master protocols to determine therapeutic agents that could fight COVID and multiple vaccine trials. I have had the wonderful opportunity to be involved in the therapeutic clinical committee of ACTIV. And given that we didn't even get together until March, by October, four or five master protocols have been launched. It's as fast as I have ever seen this happen. I encourage people that are interested to go to the website and read about these. There are master protocols in the outpatient setting to try and prevent illness and hospitalization. There are master protocols in the inpatient setting, both in the non-ICU and ICU more severe patients. And there's a master protocol that's going to have a component in the post-hospitalization setting. In addition, some master protocols are looking at repurposed drugs. Other master protocols are looking at drugs that have little clinical evidence and are starting earlier in the development program. How did we do this between March and October? Well, it's an emergency. And all of the large pharma companies basically had representation on this initiative, as well as NIH and BARDA and FDA and Operation Warp Speed, the initiative from the current administration to accelerate these vaccines and interventions. And it's just been an incredible collaboration. That can be a big motivator. And I think in an emergency situation, people want to help. How can we find drugs to treat COVID as fast as possible? The master protocol is, to me, the obvious example.
Hopefully we can figure out ways to use master protocols without relying on emergencies in the future.
Full disclosure, the vaccine trials were not run as master protocols, but if you look at the ACTIV website and talk to folks, you'll see those trials, for the most part, were run with harmonized protocols. So there was a sharing of methods. The other thing that's really important, I think, that's easy to see with the ACTIV initiative, with these different master protocols, each one of them has a clinical network that's set up, and each one of them are set up to study multiple drugs and are launched with one, two, three, or more drugs at the beginning. These are antivirals, they are immune modulators, they are supportive therapy like anticoagulants, they are monoclonal antibodies. There are a variety of drugs that are being studied. And across the ocean, the recovery trial, which I liken to a master protocol, though I don't think they call it that, I think they've studied seven agents so far, including azithromycin and hydroxychloroquine and some of the earlier drugs that people were looking at. Each of these COVID-19 therapeutic master protocols has gone to great lengths to establish global networks with 50 or 100 or more clinics. And studying multiple drugs in each one of these, just the simplest thing that you avoid is competition at the clinic. If you had a single study for every one of these drugs, they would all be in the same clinics trying to fight for the patients. So you have a coordinated effort. Now, it happens that for the first few of the active therapeutic agent master protocols, there was no biomarker matching. We don't know enough about COVID-19 yet to know what kind of patient subtypes there might be, although some evidence is coming out that some drugs help for the sicker patients, don't help as much for the less sick patients. But in terms of, for example, the outpatient trial, we don't know what the phenotypes or subtypes are going to be. So basically, the patients or the participants come into the trial, they first are randomized to any of the potential drugs and then randomized again to active or placebo if it's a matching placebo trial. Most of them are. The early ones, active one, active two, active three, and so forth. And that enables the patients to be used very efficiently. And it keeps the competition out. It's all done at random. Which drug gets patients is just a random allocation. It does pay attention to the safety exclusions that might be in place for a particular treatment. But that makes so much more sense to me than having individual trials competing for the patients. It's just more orderly. It's more organized. It's efficient. You take the human decision element out of it. You take a patient, they qualify for the master protocol. They get randomly assigned to the intervention, which could be like a subtrial if you think about it. And then they get randomly assigned again to either active or placebo. And almost all of them are add-on to standard of care. And standard of care is changing over time. And that's something else the master protocol can take advantage of. They can replace or adjust whatever the new standard of care is. When we first started designing the active protocols, remdesivir had not been shown to be effective enough to become a standard of care. It soon was. And it then became the standard of care in the early active trials. And now other drugs may come in and be standard of care, at least in the hospitalized master protocols. The master protocol is really the perfect vehicle for studying as many drugs as you can to see what's going to work in this emergency situation.
We've only just scratched the surface on this topic, and I'm sure that the listeners have many more questions. How can researchers and other stakeholders learn more about master protocols and how to use them?
I have to make a plug for the DIA. Credit the DIA with having not one, not two, but three master protocol workshops in each of the last three Octobers, 2019, 2018, 2017. I had the good fortune to be part of all three of those, and just seeing the audience, the questions, the desire to learn about the master protocols. At first, the emphasis was on how do you design one of these? How do you get it off the ground? How do you make the collaboration start? How do you build the infrastructure? And then later, what about IRB approval? How do you roll out the protocol? You know, we got very operational in terms of the questions and the sessions that were organized around those questions. And this last October, the third master protocol, there was a lot to talk about with successes, you know, and lessons learned. Just simply the evolution of those three workshops, I think, shows the growing interest and acceptance of these protocols as a viable option for studying drugs in a disease that needs some treatments. Everything I talked about, Richard, with respect to the emergency situation of the pandemic, you can take that and apply it to most any rare disease. If you think about any rare disease, there's so many rare diseases where there aren't a lot of treatment options because there may not be a commercial market for a rare disease, or it just may not be a high priority for industry to go after. Rare diseases are places where it's hard to recruit. And if you do have people working on treatments, they are competing for the same patients. Those same arguments to maximize the use of patient resources and be efficient and eliminate competition and replace it with collaboration, it all works for rare diseases. It's all very relevant for rare diseases. And that is where we've seen some new master protocols starting up, including one in muscular dystrophy that the patient advocacy group has been behind. Groups like the DIA holding workshops on master protocols that are very practical, have a lot of stories to tell, a lot of real life applications where people can listen to not just the investigators and the statisticians, but the trial coordinators, the study coordinators who are in the trenches trying to launch these complicated studies, as well as the regulators reviewing them, all of the different people contributing to a master protocol. Those workshops are great. They are just great. And I think that this year in the pandemic, the workshop was on Zoom and had an even bigger audience because people didn't have to travel. Every time a master protocol gets launched, I think a design paper needs to hit the literature. We just had a paper published in the Journal of Biopharmaceutical Statistics about the design of the PRECISE trial, which is the asthma master protocol I mentioned earlier. We need more design papers out there for master protocols so people can see what's involved in their design and in their launch. And then, of course, the results papers. The idea of a master protocol is collaborative. We need to be collaborative in sharing our lessons learned as well.
Thank you, Lissa. It's been a privilege talking with you today, Lissa. Thanks very much.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it. I love talking about master protocols. I really appreciate DIA giving me the opportunity. And I always like being interviewed by you, Richard, expert at the podcast interview.
Well, I think this is our third one. So hopefully there's more in the future. For DIA, I'm Richard Zink.
To learn more about this topic, visit us online at diaglobal.org.